Today is Friday, April 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Doctors are looking to patients who have recovered from COVID-19 for possible treatments.
We just hope it works. We want to do the right thing for our patients.
Plus, how do you have conversations with governments to make sure that extraordinary measures put in place are not abused?
Oh, that's a good, great question.
And big stars turn to teaching dance lessons online as a way to help those who are self-isolating. Those stories and more are next. Spain's health ministry said its coronavirus death toll rose to 10,935 from 10,003 the previous day, but showed the first fall in a daily death toll since March 26th. A total number of 932 people have died from the disease in the past 24 hours, down from 950 the day before. The number of registered cases rose to 117,710 on Friday, up from 110,238 on Thursday. Of the more than 1 million cases around the world, the United States has almost a quarter million, more than that of Spain and Italy, the countries with the second and third highest number of confirmed cases combined. The president of New York's Mount Sinai Hospital, Dr. David Raich, says he hopes the blood being collected from coronavirus survivors will prove to be useful in treating current COVID-19 patients.
We just hope it works. We want to do the right thing for our patients, and we don't want to just stand here idly by watching the steamroller coming at us. We want to do something. And hopefully it'll be something which causes some good.
Dr. Jeffrey Henderson of Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Missouri, adds that using blood from survivors of the coronavirus is not a cure, but could be a way to reduce the severity of COVID-19.
This is a way to make somebody immune potentially to a virus for a short period of time. And was used before there were vaccines.
And Dr. Bruce Sackis of the New York Blood Center says a coronavirus survivor who donates blood can help multiple people.
One donation, which we collect by a procedure called apheresis, can take enough plasma for two, typically three, but up to four units of plasma. So one convalescent donor can actually help up to four patients.
Nurses at the Montefiore Medical Center Moses Division in New York City protested outside their hospital in the Bronx on Thursday, holding signs and demanding more personal protective equipment, often referred to as PPE. Reuters' Ryan Brooks has that story.
Judy Sheridan Gonzalez has been a nurse for three decades. She voiced alarm at being forced to reuse face masks.
They gave us one on Monday, one on Thursday. Turn in your old one, you'll get the new one. We said that's unacceptable. Now they're saying they're going to give us one a day, where normally we would use many in a day to take care of patients. They're talking about re-sterilizing them under procedures that are not scientifically proven to be effective.
With the U.S. facing a dire shortage of protective gear, federal and local health officials have advised healthcare workers to reuse and clean their disposable masks and gloves rather than throw them away after each patient. Sheridan Gonzalez demanded the use of the U.S. Defense Production Act to push factories to churn out gear.
This is outrageous that we have people coming and sewing things for us, sewing masks, sewing shields, making things out of plastics. This is what we're doing now? I mean, that would be like a soldier going to war and making a plastic gun to bring with him.
Other nurses at Thursday's protest say terror over catching the virus is impacting their work.
It's literally frightening when you walk in there. And that, I mean, if you're spending half your brain power worrying about if you're going to die, you're not concentrating on the patient because you're just worried about not dying as you go in there. And it's very difficult. And now the ratios are even getting more. I mean, management says they're going to one nurse to 10 patients. It's sheer absurdity. It's sheer absurdity.
More people are getting sick. It may not be COVID, but it's the severity of how extreme we're working just so that we can, you know, stay safe. So it is exhausting. It is terrifying. But there's nothing we can do right now.
As of Thursday, the coronavirus outbreak has killed nearly 1,400 New Yorkers.
That was Reuters reporter Ryan Brooks. In a briefing on Thursday, Peter Navarro, the director of the U.S. Office of Trade and Manufacturing Policy, told reporters that the U.S. government is going to crack down on those stockpiling supplies, either for personal use or for export.
We're bringing that order, and what's going to do is it's going to empower Customs and Border Protection with the help of people like the Post Office and express mail consigners like UPS to basically deal with that issue. So we are going to crack down unmercifully. And I would say to the hoarders out there, the brokers who are trying to make money off the misery of people in this country or around the world, that's got to stop. But if you've got inventory, what you need to do is pick up a phone and not call somebody out in around the world. You call FEMA and say, we got some stuff, we'll give it to you at a fair price.
As the cases of COVID-19 continues to grow, a British doctor working in an intensive care unit took to social media to share his symptoms after getting ill. David Hepburn has since returned to work and posted a video online sharing his story.
I just wanted to share with you how I got coronavirus. At the moment, my team in the intensive care unit are looking after a lot of patients who are critically unwell with coronavirus. Some of them are younger than I am, and they're certainly not the frail elderly people that maybe some of us have been led to believe we would be seeing. They're young, they're fit, and they have young families. As do I. I'd like to tell you that I got coronavirus from heroically looking after some of these patients, but actually the reality is much more mundane. I think I probably caught this from contact with colleagues at work, possibly, and possibly someone out in the street before any of the coronavirus patients really arrived on the intensive care unit. It started off very innocuously. I had a burning sensation in my nose. I lost the sense of taste. I never had a cough. And then I've had a week of just feeling absolutely terrible, aching muscles, aching bones, and unable to get out of bed, sleeping 16, 18 hours a day. I'm on the mend now, thankfully, I hope. But I can't emphasize to you how sick this can make you. Please, please listen to the advice that's going around at the minute. This is a small sacrifice for a short period of time, and then life will get back to normal again. But we have to protect everybody, and we have to protect the NHS. Thanks.
Dr. Talal Insuli, clinical professor of immunology at Georgetown University, and a research scientist at its International Center for Immunology Studies, told VOA's Mohammed Elshenawy about the two strains of COVID-19 circulating. He says there were early warning signs a pandemic of this nature was coming.
There are two types of viruses, the coronavirus. Of the coronavirus called L, coronavirus 19 called L, and the coronavirus called S. So the coronavirus L is the one that caused the major damage versus the coronavirus S has much less morbidity and mortality. What's the percentage? Out of 100 coronavirus, 30% are the S, the good ones, 70% of them are the bad ones. So most likely, not only were there a lot of tourists coming from China that were in Italy, tons of them were there, especially Milano and the area, and most likely they brought with them the L type, the aggressive type of coronavirus 19. And I'm not worrying only about Italy, which is very unfortunate, but if you look at the map of the globe, the whole globe is affected. People are dying in hundreds of people every hour on the hour. Your interview right now, during your interview, more than 500 people died. This is totally unacceptable. So I'm a little bit mad about the situation. I'm going to tell you why. This is a slap on the face of the scientists. It's a slap on the face of physicians on this earth. We are allowing people to die. We are totally powerless. So it's a major challenge for us. A vexing challenge. We're unable to come out of the treatment to stop this disaster from occurring. Thousands of people died, and we still do not have any treatment available for them, and this is totally unacceptable. Furthermore, I will blame the politicians that are in this world from any country, but no one was looking at something. No one was talking about the potential invasion by a deadly virus. In 2007, there was a paper published in the International Clinical Microbiology Journal, published by the Chinese University. They mentioned verbatim, warning us that something bad is going to happen, that we all have to be very prepared for that. Why? The presence of large reservoir of SARS coronavirus-like viruses in the horseshoe and bats in China, together with the culture of eating exotic mammals in southern China, Did anyone took seriously this warning that was published in an official medical journal in 2007? No one. And this was a report by the American Society of Microbiology. Unfortunately, no one listened to them. No one was ready. We don't have enough masks, N95. We don't have alcohol gel. We don't have protection, personal equipment. Shame on ourselves. Shame of the humanity on this earth. We don't have Clorox to clean and to disinfect the hospitals. We physicians, we don't have access to these things. This is unbelievable, unacceptable. So I think this is a lesson for the whole, all the humanity, politicians, scientists, and the public health individuals. Let's get ready for this, please, all of us.
Debate on the usage of anti-malarial drugs to combat the coronavirus pandemic rages on as the drugs are rushed to be used on an emergency basis for patients with acute respiratory problems. VOA's Salem Solomon has those details.
As anti-malaria drugs gain approval to treat certain coronavirus patients, experts urge caution. On Monday, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration gave short-term authorization to use two drugs, hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine, to treat coronavirus in certain emergency cases. The drugs are being distributed to hospitals and are to be used for patients exhibiting acute respiratory problems. President Donald Trump pushed for the authorization after a promising small-scale study in France showed hydroxychloroquine in combination with an antibiotic helped the recovery of coronavirus patients.
We're going to be able to make that drug available almost immediately, and that's where the FDA has been so great. They've gone through the approval process. It's been approved, and they did it. They took it down from many, many months to immediate. So we're going to be able to make that drug available by prescription.
Dr. Jeff Collier, a surgeon and the former governor of Kansas, has been an advocate for exploring the drug, saying it's one of the only medications available that has shown promise. Still, he said, it's not a cure-all and should be administered only by a physician.
This is not something where you should go to the pharmacy and purchase it and use it yourself because you think you're sick. It's most important that you and your doctor make a decision on whether it's appropriate for you. Right now, there are shortages of these medications worldwide, and so they really need to be reserved for the sickest patients.
Collier believes the urgency of the pandemic, which has infected over 850,000 people and killed more than 40,000 worldwide, demands quick action and unorthodox measures. He acknowledges the drug's efficacy is far from proven.
We need more data and more evidence in this. I'm the first person to say I've seen drugs that have looked promising and then they've turned out not to work so well. This is the one that we have. And so, as I say, you know, you go to war with the army you have, not the one that you wish you had, but then you keep on building with this.
Another study of about 100 patients in China found no evidence hydroxychloroquine helped combat coronavirus. The drugs, which have been in use since the 1950s to treat malaria, also have rare but dangerous side effects. Some experts have expressed unease to the speed of the approval. Dr. Cyrus Shapar is a physician and director of the Prevent Epidemics team at Resolve to Save Lives, a global public health organization with operations in Africa. He told VOA that even if the positive results from the small study can be replicated, there is no information on how patients will do on a long-term basis.
We don't usually make recommendations based on trials of 40 people or 100 people, because it's not enough people to know what the side effects are. It's not enough people to know, you know, for all the different age groups or sexes, you know, how does this drug work? We just don't have that evidence right now.
Shapar added that there are clinical trials going on around the world right now, and there may be better information about the drug's performance as soon as later this month. He also worries the drug being diverted from places in Africa and elsewhere where it's needed to protect against malaria.
So I think we've jumped the gun a bit in terms of trying to make this something that, you know, is a magic bullet for COVID-19. It isn't. It might have impact, but we don't know that yet.
Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
And still to come,
it makes you think. You have to be really, really creative. And so we thought that if we add the theme of Disney to it, or to add any sort of theme that the kids can follow, they could dress up with. If you don't want to dress up, you can wear a color that matches it. If you don't want to wear the color, you can draw us a picture, write us a letter. So it's literally been amazing to find creative ways to keep kids with us interested and always do something at home, because I think it's really important for parents as well.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. On yesterday's program, I spoke with Augusta University political science professor Craig Albert about the challenges democracies face when governments enact bolder measures during a crisis. Albert said that generally, societies favor greater security measures, but how can constituencies have meaningful dialogue with governments to ensure that these powers are not abused?
Oh, that's a great question. Part of the nature of democracy in general, and this is something that democratic philosophers, democratic theorists have warned us about, is that once they become more centralized, once they start siding with security over liberty, it encroaches towards that more authoritarian form of democracy more and more. And it's harder and harder each time an action is taken towards security over liberty to go back to the normal part of liberty being the point of democracy. I'm getting trapped in democratic philosophy here, but the point is that the further towards authoritarianism, which is part of a democracy, you know, you go towards security at some point. The further you go towards that, the more times you utilize it, the harder and harder it is to go back to the normalization of liberty, of freedom. And so we don't know in this type of global pandemic how we can dialogue with the government, how we can be cautious of this. The great, you know, philosophers say you can't go back, but part of me doesn't want to believe that, just because you see so many governments starting to enact these types of, even states and local municipalities in the United States itself, you know, on a federal level, you see more and more governments going towards more and more authoritarian measures. And there's a tipping point where there's no point of return. So how do you handle this? This is a question that philosophers have been, you know, debating since the Enlightenment. I think the best thing we can do is be active on social media right now. You know, organizations, groups, citizens, activists, free speech activists, all journalists, all of these need to be holding the governments to account, really questioning them and calling them out, especially on social media, to make sure that when the threat dissipates, when the pandemic decreases to an acceptable level to allow things theoretically to be the normal again, that's when we should really be forcing the government's hands to go back to the new normal. And it might require, in the next round of elections in all these countries, where you vote for non-traditional parties or individuals or newcomers that say they will bring it back to the new normal. So it could be the, you know, free and fair elections that allow governments to go back to preferring liberty over security in these times of crisis. But that's up to the people to enact. And, you know, studies show that once the people get normalized to security apparatus and the security infrastructure in a democracy, they don't go back. They feel that that's the new normal. So it kind of creates a new identity in democratic citizens, that they become institutionalized to the new security measures put in place, much like you see with the United States after the Patriot Act was passed. That's the new normal, and we don't see it as that big of a threat as a national political value.
Craig Albert is a political science professor at Augusta University here in the United States. Tensions are soaring in Syrian prisons as the prospect of trials for accused Islamic State militants have been sidelined by the coronavirus threat. Officials say a prison riot over the weekend was contained and that no one escaped, but they warn that prisons in northeastern Syria will remain a ticking bomb without international support. VOA's Heather Murdoch has this report from a recent trip to Hasekha, Syria.
These men have been in this prison for more than a year, since Islamic State militants were defeated in their last stronghold in Syria. Thousands of the prisoners in northeastern Syria are foreigners from 50 different countries. None have been investigated, charged, or tried. After repeated unanswered calls for countries to take back their nationals or form an international court, the regional government here was planning to start holding trials last month. Prisoners said a judgment, any judgment, would be better than the endless wait.
There's people maybe saying that this is the best kind of punishment that
Even before the coronavirus, there were questions about whether the trials would take place as declared. Now, with the global pandemic threatening the region, the promised proceedings have been postponed indefinitely. Over the weekend, riots broke out in the prison. Officials in northeastern Syria have said repeatedly that they cannot alone protect, guard, and serve justice to the more than 10,000 suspected militants in their custody.
These prisoners were the ones that fought to the end. We defeated them, but they fought until the last minute. They are not just a threat to Syria, but to the whole world.
There are also thousands of foreign wives and children detained in camps that are increasingly radicalized. Women enforce strict IS rules, stage attacks against guards, and openly call for the return of the caliphate. Children growing up here don't go to school, and many say they plan to grow up to be militants, like their fathers, who are now all missing, detained, or dead. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Hasaka and Al-Hol Camp in Syria.
With nations locked down and people quarantined to prevent the spread of the coronavirus, one pair of professional dancers is using online classes to help the homebound get some exercise. As VOA's David Byrd reports, husband and wife dancers Oti Mabusi and Marius Yepere are teaching online classes from their London living room.
Most people know South African-born dancer Oti Mabusi and her husband Marius Yepere from Britain's Strictly Come Dancing television show. Now they are helping people locked in by the coronavirus to learn dances, to get some exercise, and to keep kids active by teaching free daily classes online.
Okay, so let's just try that little bit with music. Once again, if you don't get it, it is absolutely okay.
From the beginning.
Mabuse says because children are out of school and watching the videos on YouTube and Facebook, they decided to incorporate dances from Disney movies, including Aladdin, Jungle Book, Mary Poppins, and others. She told the Associated Press they cater the routines to the audience.
It makes you think. You have to be really, really creative. And so we thought that if we add the theme of Disney to it, or to add any sort of themes that the kids can follow, they could dress up with. If you don't want to dress up, you can wear a color that matches it. If you don't want to wear the color, you can draw us a picture, or write us a letter. So it's literally been amazing to find creative ways to keep kids with us interested and always do something at home, because I think it's really important for parents as well. They want to have something that their kids do, and this was one of them.
The creativity extends to changing the living room of their home as well. Mabuse says Yepere came up with the idea of moving their sofas around to make the space look different.
So every week, because we've been doing this for 2 weeks now, every week he switched the sofa, so it always looks like a different place, and we shoot it from different ways. So that's been amazing.
Oti Mabuse says she has been inspired by the feedback she received from children, parents, and especially from healthcare worker Mina Walsh at Birmingham Children's Hospital, who makes full costumes to go with the dances.
She makes the full outfits. So like there's one where I did Shrek and she had a full donkey outfit. When I did Mary Poppins, she wore the whole thing. And she does the dances for the kids in the hospital. And that's been amazing. And she's like, the kids are so happy. And to offer them something that at least, you know, 11:30, I get to dress up. I'm going to dance with this lady that I see on my phone every single day. That's something that we just wanted to push, the positivity and the fun activities at home.
Mabuse's Strictly Come Dancing co-star Karen Hauer and her husband are also posting classes online for families and couples. The dance lessons are not just for kids. Both Mabuse and Hauer offer free classes for adults, including the jive, the cha-cha, and Latin dancing. Oti Mabuse says she always wants to remind people to remain positive, to be safe, and to take care of themselves. In Washington, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
And with that, that'll do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Stay healthy and have a great weekend.